Okay, good evening, everyone. The topic tonight is titled, Can a Government Paskin Halacha? Understanding the Parameters of Dina de Malchus Adina and Paying Taxes and Other Related Questions. This is a very difficult topic to discuss for many, many reasons, which will become quite clear as we go through the topic inside with the cases and the makoros. Very, very difficult to discuss, not so clear in terms of some of the practical applications. And some of the ones that are clear are sometimes very difficult to follow. So that will be the bit of our Hagdama. I'll just mention one or two other important points at the beginning of Hashkafa. Ben Mantheim sent me an email, which I thought was a nice point, that he mentioned something that he had heard from, I think it was the Shmooze, if you've heard of the Shmooze.com. It originates in New York, in Muncie and Chavetz Chaim in Queens. Excellent organization. And he mentioned that somebody, I think it was, I forgot the name of the person who spoke. It was the head of the Shmooze, Rabbi Schaffer? Rabbi Schaffer. So he happened to mention on this topic about taxes just at a very important Hashkafa point, which I think is a good idea to mention. And that is the following. When we talk about taxes and not paying taxes or trying to avoid certain aspects of the law, which we'll discuss more in detail, some people apparently think, and this will be referring now to cases that we say are usser. Whatever cases we say are usser will be included in this comment. People think, well, if I'm going to avoid the tax or try to get out of it, it must be that I need the money. I think that I need to keep the money. I don't have enough money, or I want to try to keep it for myself, and therefore that's part of the reason why people sometimes try to get out of paying certain kinds of taxes. The problem is that we know clearly from the Gemara and other sources that a person's sustenance, a person's parnasa, the Gemara calls it his mizonos, is set, is katsuv, is ketuv in law from Rosh Hashanah. Hashem determines for us on Rosh Hashanah how much parnasa we are going to have that year. And according to the simple understanding here, anything that you do during the year is not going to change that. It may change where you get your parnasa from or how it comes or when it comes, but it's not going to change the amount of parnasa that you get. So Rabbi Schaefer's comment, if I believe I'm quoting it correctly here, is that based on that, there's no reason why we should be trying to avoid or evade the law in situations where it's not allowed. Because even if we say at the end of the day, fine, we gained ourselves a couple $1,000, whatever the case might be, at the same time, if Hashem sees that and he says, well, you were supposed to get a certain amount of money, so he might still give you the same amount of money, but you're going to lose out somewhere else. If you got the money through the taxes, you're going to lose out somewhere else. And the point is that Hashem perhaps might be thinking, I'm going to give for the next year or whatever the time might be, I'm going to give people money only if I see that they're responsible in how they use their money. And if I see, says Hashem, that they're not responsible in terms of what they do with their money or what they keep or don't keep, then perhaps they don't deserve to have that money in the first place. And I thought that was a very nice hashkafic point, which is a very important idea to begin our introduction to the discussion of taxes. We'll end at the very end, hopefully, with another hashkafic point, which is at the end of your Maror Makomos here, which we'll get to, God willing, a little bit later. Okay. So let's begin. What is the basis for all these discussions about keeping the law and paying taxes and all sorts of other similar cases? So the answer, of course, everybody knows what it's called. This is a very, very famous phrase in the Gemara. What's the Gemara's language for keeping the law, the secular law of the land? Thank you. Dina de Malchus Adina. So we're not going to go through the whole case now in the Gemara inside. I'll just summarize for you the background, a little bit of the background. And we're not going to get into all the details here. But the Gemara, it surfaces in the Gemara a number of different times, this concept of Dina de Malchus Adina. The first case in source number one, and again, we're going to start right in, just pick out the line in the middle, but the background here is that Shmuel says the following, that property that belongs to a non-Jew is considered to be like a desert. That anybody who takes it, it belongs to them. Why is that? So the Gemara says that immediately when a non-Jew acquires money, let's try it the other way around. Ove kochavim michimatu zuze liadei istalekle. When a non-Jew, let's say, sells something to a Jew, so he gets the money for the sale. At that moment, the halacha is that he loses ownership of the item that he's selling. But the Jew, it says, li'israel lokani ad mati shtar liadei. But the Jew doesn't actually acquire the object until until the shtar, according to this Gemara at least, until the shtar is actually comes to his hand. Again, the details we're not going to discuss now. It's not really our point. The point is hilkach harein kemidbar. The point is that somewhere in between, after the goy has lost ownership of the object and before the Jew gets ownership of the object, the Gemara says v'chol machzik ben zochah b'ha, and anybody else who picks it up legally, halachically, should own the object. So the Gemara says, according to that, wait a second. Did Shmuel really say that? Shmuel said, "Dina d'balchus adina," that we should follow the law of the land, and apparently the law in that land, at the time, the Gemara says that the king said that that the only way to acquire the land is ella b'igrita, which is with the salary, with the money. So then the Gemara goes back and forth and says, well, I don't really know what he meant about that, but I have another case and a support, etc., etc., etc. The details, again, are not for now, but what's clear from this Gemara, as well as a number of other Gemaras, is that at least according to Shmuel, and it's interesting, Shmuel is the first source for Dina d'Malchus Adina. We won't go into that aspect of this now, but Shmuel is clearly one of the main source for this in the Gemara. He holds that we follow the secular law of the land. That's the case of the Gemara, and that is what Shmuel says here. The question is, what exactly are the parameters of Dina d'Malchus Adina? When does it apply? How far-reaching is the scope of Dina d'Malchus Adina? And what are the reasons why Dina d'Malchus Adina applies? Before we get to that, we're not going to go into this in detail, but many of the Rishonim actually assume that Dina d'Malchus Adina is a D'oraisa concept, even though in the Gemara never actually explicates a biblical source for this concept, but according to many Rishonim, they feel that this definitely has some sort of D'oraisa element. There is a minority opinion that holds that it's only D'rabbanan, but definitely a major opinion here is that it's D'oraisa. Again, we're not going to get into the details now about exactly how they derive it, what it's based on. There are different theories for this. Rav Schechter has a great article on the topic here in the RJJ Journal from 1981, so he quotes a number of theories about that. There are other discussions as well, but for now, that's essentially the background that we need to go on for at least some of the practical cases. So let's talk about some of the reasons behind it, and then we'll get to some of the questions about parameters. What do you think might be the reason why Dina d'Malchus Adina would be logical or would take effect according to Shmuel? Why does it make sense that we should follow the law, the secular law of the land, the law of the of the secular government?
To protect ourselves.
Okay, are you both saying the same thing?
Or?
Okay, Ben said pikuach nefesh, and Eric said to protect yourselves. What did you mean by that? It's okay. I'm just asking you. I'm not trying to attack you. Pikuach nefesh. Okay, good. So,
as opposed to saying that, to show that, like, to as opposed to saying it should be that the Kohen should see us do, you know, not a little things, not from their perspective, but from our perspective.
Right. Okay, good. So, at the end of the day, are you saying the same thing or not? I'm still not sure.
I guess so.
Okay.
I'm saying that, you know, life in Kutaris is fragile, and if you start breaking the law, it's one more excuse for people to butcher us.
Good. Okay.
What about just playing for the Lashem?
Okay.
Does that mean that Israel doesn't have to keep the law?
We'll come to that. Okay, so let's hold off on Chil Hashem for the time being. That may come up a little bit later. It definitely is a discussion.
Yeah. To protect ourselves physically.
Okay.
Also look at it spiritually.
Okay, so good. So that's...
I could say another reason is because when you are a guest in someone's house, you should do...
Okay, good. So those are two of the reasons that are given by the Rishonim. The first reason is mentioned by some of the Rishonim is pretty close to what Ben said, that basically we have to protect ourselves. We have to make sure that that we can stay, and if we don't follow the law of the land, not specifically the Jews, but just in general, society can't function. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos which says that if you don't have a law, so ish es re'eu chayim b'lo, every person will swallow his friend alive. It's hefker, right? There's no way that you can function without a regular society of law, and therefore you must follow the law of the land, even if it's not in Eretz Yisrael, even if it's in some other government. That's one possible approach to understanding Dina d'Malchus Adina. What'd you say? So one of the shevamitzvos B'nei Noach is to establish a system of law, a court of law, of dinim, which is certainly related to this, maybe not exactly the same thing, but definitely is along the same lines. A second reason offered by the Rishonim is basically what David said, that what are we doing here? The point is that we are... at least not in Eretz Yisrael now, let's talk about in Chutz Laaretz. Dina d'Malchus Adina, the base principle appears to apply to laws in other governments. It may be based according to some on the parsha of Melech in the Torah, that is what some suggest, that maybe the whole basis for this is based on the fact that the Torah allows us to have a king, and the king has a certain amount of power to legislate laws. So it could be a din de malchus, a din is based on that. But in the Gemara, it seems to be that that applies specifically to non-Jewish rulership or kings. And the point is, they let us live in their land. They're nice enough, to gracious enough to let us live there. And therefore, we have to keep their laws, because if we don't keep their laws, they can say, get out. They could say, if you don't keep my laws, you shouldn't live here. And therefore, you need to leave. The resulting conclusion would be, we should keep their laws if we want to remain in any given place. And that's essentially the opinion of the Ran, which we will get to in a couple minutes for other aspects of that halacha as well. There's a third explanation also, and there's actually more than this. These are just three. We'll just stick to these three for now. A third explanation, which is given by some of the Rishonim, and this is on the source sheet, so we can take a look at this inside. The Rashbam, in source number two, basically spells out the third opinion. Take a look at source number two. V'hamar Shmuel dina d'malchus adina. So the Rashbam explains, kol misim v'arnonios u'minhago shal mishpatei malachim shiragilim lahanhig v'malchusam dinahu. That all the types of taxes, different kinds of taxes and rules that the kings are accustomed to institute in their kingdom is considered to be law. Why? Shekol b'nei ha-malchus mekablim aleihem neiratzonam chukei ha-melech. Because all of the kings have accepted upon themselves, shekol b'nei ha-malchus, sorry, that all the people that reside in the kingdom have accepted upon themselves meiratzonam, out of their own ratzon, out of their own desire, chukei ha-melech, the laws of the king and his statutes, u'mishpatav, and his laws. V'hilkach, he says, din gomer, who it's considered to be an absolute din, an absolute law, that this is true. And then he goes into the case in the Gemara, which we're not going to get into now, but he says, v'ein l'machzik m'mon chaveru, al pi chok ha-melech hanog b'ir mishum gezel. There's no problem of holding on to money that belongs to somebody else if it's according to the laws of the land. There's no problem of gezel. That we are not going to get into now. That is a tough issue, which we're not going to really focus on. But the point of the Rashbam essentially is that you can follow the laws of the land that you live in, specifically because what we call a principle called Haskamat HaToshavim, that everybody that lives there has accepted upon themselves willingly that they are subject to the rules of the king. What you would call it today in modern societies, you probably would call that essentially democracy, meaning if the democratic people elect officials of government, and then those officials of government make certain laws, so then by virtue of the fact that it's a democracy, people need to follow it because they elected the rulers, and therefore they understand that certain rules are going to be made, certain legislation is going to be instituted, and people voluntarily, in general, the general rule is that people voluntarily accept that. And I'm not saying that there aren't exceptions, but that's the rule, and therefore, based on that rule, Dina d'Malchus Adina applies. That's essentially the opinion of the Rambam as well, in source number three, which we won't read inside, but it's in Hilchos Gzeilah V'Aveilah Parakei, Halacha Yudches, I think it is. Basically the same idea, that the people of the land have accepted upon themselves the rulership of those that rule the land. So those are, for now, at least three basic approaches to why Dina d'Malchus Adina should have effect. Any questions so far? Again, just basic questions. I don't want any detailed questions yet, but just the basic understanding questions based on what we've done. The basic idea is pretty much clear.
Why is everyone's consensus binding on me?
Why is everyone?
Agreement. You all agree you want to pay taxes. Why is it binding on me? I don't understand that further.
What'd you say? So,
you all decide you want to pay taxes. Fine, go ahead. Why does it mean that? Why does that make it a deal?
Well, here's the problem. If you...
Because
what I understand is that there's two elements here. Element number one is that certainly you can have individuals that don't accept the law, but the point is that I don't know exactly what the measurement is, either if it's rove or overwhelming rove. The basic idea is that in general, kimat everybody in the land accepts and wants the government to rule in whatever way they see fit, and that will involve certain things that you have to pay. Therefore, since kimat everybody accepts that, even if one individual does not accept it, then you would probably say that it's that you have to follow it. The second element,
why?
Because that's the idea of having a king that rules over you. If you don't accept the rulership of that king, maybe you can't live there. I don't know.
Okay.
That's the question. I mean, if you accept the rulership of the king, then this far applies. If you don't accept the rulership of the king, then the question is, well, what else don't you accept, and what are going to be the consequences of that? Maybe you'll be a board of malchus, chas v'shalom. The other part of that is also anything that the king does, or today in democratic societies, essentially you would have to say, well, if I don't accept what they do, then I can't get any benefit at all from anything that they do in the society, meaning the roads, anything that the taxes go for, essentially, the army protecting you, whatever the case might be. And this is going to be relevant a little bit later when we get into some of the modern applications, specifically in Eretz Yisrael, and that's going to be a very important question. You know, if you don't pay taxes in Israel, then maybe every single thing that the money for taxes goes to, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to get benefit from that. And to be honest, some people, there are some extremists, we'll call them, they're at least consistent. They don't get benefit from certain things in Eretz Yisrael because they say, I don't accept the Medina and I don't pay taxes. We'll get to that a little bit later, but if you wanted to be consistent, presumably that's what you'd have to say. There are a lot of things that the tax money goes for that you wouldn't be allowed to use, including the roads. Including the roads. So that's, I think that would be the way to approach that.
There's also an extreme sheet on the opposite end.
Yeah.
This is that you're paying taxes to Medina, that could be considered your miser road.
So the miser issue we'll discuss in a separate shir in a couple of weeks. I'm not sure if I necessarily agree with that, but we'll, right. So I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, but we'll talk about that. Understood. So okay, we'll talk about that. Hopefully, we'll have a separate shir on miser stuff, and then we can discuss some of those questions a little more in depth. Okay, good. That's basically some of the reasons for why Dina d'Malchus Adina applies. In a couple of minutes, we'll come back to that and see exactly which reasons are pasuk in lahalacha and how that plays itself out in terms of certain specific rules. The next question that we have to deal with before we move on is, what exactly is the scope of dina d'malchus adina? Let's just give a little bit of an outlandish case here, but you'll get the point. If the government told me that I absolutely must turn on the radio on Shabbos, not because it's an emergency, God forbid, but just because the government says that any person who does not turn on a radio on Shabbos violates the law, everybody has to know what's happening, the latest news is, and if you are caught, there will be inspectors going around. If you are caught, you will absolutely have to pay a $3,000 fine. Do you have to do that based on Dina d'Malchus Adina? Are you allowed to do that based on Dina d'Malchus Adina? No, I didn't say leave it on. I said turn it on. I said turn it on. I didn't say leave it on. No. It's got to be off overnight, but then you have to turn it on Saturday morning. Or the government says that it's that eating pig is very healthy, and therefore, in order to avoid something, we recommend that every person has to.
In specific cases, you aren't allowed to keep Shabbos. You aren't allowed to do Chanukah.
Okay, so
no,
go
you
on.
Can ask a specific story.
Okay. So let's put it this way, okay? Any case which is potentially pikuach nefesh, that your life potentially is in danger, that's not what we're discussing here. Clearly, that case, you're allowed to do whatever you need to do if there's a possibility that your life might be in danger. What I'm saying here is that... Say again?
Except for the big three
averos of Gilaras, Shvi Chasdam, and Avodah Zarah. What I'm asking is, if there's just a secular law, the rule is that this is what you have to do, and that rule violates Hilchos Shabbos or Hilchos Kashrus or something like that, does Dina d'Malchus Adina apply, and why? Why or why not? Why not, Chaim? Or why? He said no. So why not? Okay. That might be true, but let's say the rule is that you have to do it yourself. Again, I'm just making up a case, but I want to illustrate the point here. The question is, the basic question that this is all based on is, are there limits to Dina d'Malchus Adina? Is there some sort of boundary that past a certain point is not included in this rule? And the answer is absolutely yes. There is absolutely a boundary. It does not go over that boundary. The question is, what exactly is that boundary? So now.
First of all, from the Rashban, you see that Dina d'Malchus Adina only works for Dina Mamunah.
Excellent. So that's essentially the answer. That's what most of the poskim say. Yeah, that Dina d'Malchus Adina is not a principle which applies across the board. And Rosh Schechter also discusses this a little bit in his article. It can't be, and the Rishonim discussed this as well. You can't possibly have a rule of Dina d'Malchus Adina that would be across the board. You could potentially get rid of half of the Torah. You can't have that. That's obviously not what's meant here. What's meant here is that Dina d'Malchus Adina dictates that in terms of Dina Momenos, in terms of civil laws, that's where we say that the law of the land is considered to be the law according to the halacha as well. Now that also is going to be a bit of a question exactly where it applies, but that's the starting point. The starting point that everybody agrees to is that Dina d'Malchus Adina is relegated to the realm of Dina Momenos only. Yeah, John.
Happened many times.
Yeah. Good question. So the Ramah actually says, and we'll discuss this again in a minute or two, The Ramah actually says that apparently that's the kind of case that you would have to pay a tax for, believe it or not. We'll come back to that when we read source number 7. It's going to be another 2 or 3 minutes here. We'll read source number 7 inside. This is the last question, by the way, before we go on for this section.
I'm going to kind of what we're talking about with the development of the Dina. Does it come to be more makel than the rabbanim, for instance? Like, you know, if somebody's high of kefil, right? They stole something, they owed double the amount.
Excellent question. So this is the subject of a major machlokas, which we are not going to have time to get into in detail at this moment. What I can tell you is that, let's see if I can find it on the sheet here. I don't see it on the sheet right now. Let me read to you the following. Okay. Let me read to you the following. We'll discuss one aspect of the parameters of Dina de Machlus Adina, and then we'll discuss your question for just a minute, and then we'll go on. Take a look at source number 8. And this is going to focus on the question of what the parameters are. We're not going to read the whole thing because it's a little bit long. But if you take a look in the middle, let's say, is it page 2? I think it's page 2 still. The page that source number 8 begins on, take a look at the third line from the bottom, third word in on the line, after the parentheses of Maharik, where it says Yud Aleph, Yesh Omrim. Okay? So this is going to give us a bit of an idea of when Dina de Malchus Adina applies. What is the scope of Dina de Malchus Adina? So the Ramah says, this is all the Ramah here, Yesh Omrim. Tulo Amin and Dina de Malchus Adina Ela B'misim U'mechasim HaTzluyim B'karka. Some people say that Dina de Malchus Adina only applies to taxes that are related to land. It's only about land taxes. Ki HaMelech Gozer Shelo Yadzur Ba'artso Ki Mederech Zeh. Because the king decrees that you cannot live in the lands, meaning it's all about living in the land. The king decrees you cannot live in the land unless you pay these taxes. Aval Shard Varm Lo. But other things are not included in Dina de Malchus Adina. Who does he quote here? So this in the Ramah seems to be based on the Rosh and the Maharam and the Mordechai. We also saw echoes of that in the Ran before. This seems somewhat similar to the Ran Sfar that we saw before, which we'll come back to a little bit later. He continues, V'yesh Chokin, but others disagree, V'svir Lehu, Zamrina, the Chol Davar Dina de Malchus Adina, that everything is included. Again, everything here does not mean everything. Everything means all areas of Dina and Momenos. And therefore, according to this opinion, Dina de Malchus Adina applies to all aspects of Dina Momenos, apparently even when it goes against the din according based on the halacha. And the Ramah gives an example here. V'lachin amal v'la mashkon yachol amachra achar shana. The Ramah says, therefore, somebody who lends money to somebody else with collateral, he gets the malva gets some sort of collateral. So according to the halacha, so already after, I think it's 30 days, he is allowed to make use of that collateral if he has not gotten his money back in return. He could already sell it. He could do whatever he wants with it. Apparently, the Ramah says here, based on earlier Rishonim, that in their time, the law was a little bit different. In their time, the law was that yachol lemachor achar shana. They can sell it only after a year. That's different than the halacha. Ho v'chein dinim d'malchusa. He says that's the rule of the land. So even though it goes against the strict halachic rule, the point is for dinim momenos, according to the second opinion, all these kinds of things are included in dinim d'malchusa dina, and the halacha should be overridden by the secular law. And the Ramah says v'chein hu ikr, and that is, according to the Ramah at least, that is the accepted opinion. Now,
Is it the Ramah?
The law itself, I don't think, is going to be Doraisa, but the point is that Dina de Malchus Adina, whatever scope it might have, apparently is able to override that law. Meaning, built into the Torah framework is that the Dina Momenos aspect of the Torah applies in a Torah society, but in a non-Torah society, you can follow the other rules that they have in that society as well. And this extends to other cases as well, which we'll discuss a little bit later when we get to the scenarios. Just to point out here, though, actually, it's in the Maror Makomos also. Take a look at source number 9. I just copied a couple paragraphs here in English just to make it easier for you to understand rather than quote the Shach inside from Rabbi Chaim Jachter from TABC at his website koltorah.org, which is their school website. So he has a number of articles which deal briefly with Dina de Malchus Adina. So there's a famous Shach which disagrees with this. We'll read it in the summary here. The Shach strongly disagrees with the Ramah. He writes, since according to Halacha, the lender may sell the collateral after 30 days of default, how can we follow the Nachri laws and ignore the Torah law? God forbid! Such a matter should not happen in the Jewish community. That's what the Shach says. The Shach disagrees with the Ramah. The Shach essentially says, anything which there is a clear Torah basis for the halacha being different than the secular law, you cannot follow the din of Malchusa. Rather, you have to follow the Torah law, at the very least when you have two Jews that are doing business together. The Chazon Ish takes that a little bit further. He doesn't quote it in this piece here, but the Chazon Ish says, well, if you take that approach, according to the Shach, not only should you say that any law which is explicit according to the halacha should be followed, but you can derive any law according to the Torah. What do you think all of modern contemporary halacha is all about? It's all about taking a modern question, finding some diuk from some Rishon or Achron, and saying, based on this, the following should be the halacha. Every single question has some sort of answer in the halacha, and therefore, according to the Chazon Ish, everything has to be based on halacha. Even things which are not explicit in the poskim should still be based on halacha. However, as Rav Jachta writes here, nonetheless, many poskim rule in accordance with the view of the Ramah. These authorities include the Chasam Sofer, the Imre Yosher, the Dovid Misharim, the Igros Moshe, and Rav Henkin. And that is, generally speaking, the accepted halacha. Most poskim follow, not all, but most poskim follow the Ramah here, that anything which has within Dine Mamonos a contradiction between the Torah law and the secular law, we follow the secular law, at least when it comes to Dine Mamonos. Okay, that's to answer your question. That's a very important point when it comes to understanding the parameters of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Okay, any questions so far? And good? Okay, let's go on. Based on what we've just said, so we can already start to look at scenario number one. So in scenario number one, let's read it inside. This is a question of, I guess we'll call it Jewish law versus common law. My company, this is my own case, by the way, my company has made a deal with another company to sell or buy a product. We shook hands and considered the deal final, but now the other company wants to back out. Are they allowed to, according to halacha? What about according to secular law? This here, I think here might be a difference between the two source sheets. I think I changed a little bit in the second source sheet. Does it matter if the two companies are run by religious Jews? So everybody understand the question? I think I had another line in one of the source sheets here. If halacha takes a different position than the secular law in terms of whether the deal is final or not. What would you say in this case, very briefly?
It doesn't matter. Once you give your word, the deal's done.
Again, according to secular law, this is true. Yeah.
I'm talking about according to halacha.
You say according to halacha also. No, why? Yeah.
According to halacha, there's a purist. If you're handing over the money, is actually
yeah,
the,
still be a master.
No, your word alone.
The person can also have a curse at the portal. You have
Mishapara. Okay, good.
Mishapara
right,
curse,
right.
But I can't force
good.
You in court to follow your word.
Correct.
I think there's a lot of works about if the situation has changed from the time the agreement has made fundamentally such that if the person had known that at the time when they made the agreement that the situation was going to be entirely different.
Mekachtos. Okay, good. So you're all correct. The answer is that the answer is complicated, but the bottom line, generally speaking, is that usually to be absolutely buying according to halacha, you need to have some sort of masa kinyon. Again, it depends on the case exactly, and there might be exceptions to the rule, absolutely. If things change, mekachtos is definitely an issue, which with a lot of detailed halachas, which if we want to discuss that in one of the later shiurim, that is another good interesting topic to discuss. But basically, that's the rule according to halacha. You, generally speaking, need to have a masa kinyan. If you didn't, if you gave your word, you may have a curse put on you called mishapara, which the Mishnah has discussed in, I think it's both in Metzia. But in terms of the bottom line, what tachas, you know, what do you have to give back and what's actually binding, the answer is that it's not usually binding. According to secular law, at least in the United States and in other places, what do we say about a handshake often? You tell me. Say again?
It's your word.
Good. So often the case is that it depends on your word and something like that. Not always, but often that's the case.
When
the point here, yeah.
Okay,
100%. What we want to get out of here is the principle behind the matter. What's the principle? So the answer is that this could be a case where you might potentially say that the halacha contradicts the secular law of when the sale is binding. At the end of the day, it's not so simple because the halacha also sometimes recognizes secular, what we call the minhag ha-medina. There's a certain kinyanim called situmta, which is a question of what that is, but it may be that that refers to any kinyanim which the general custom of people in the business accept that as being a binding kinyan. So that is true even within the halacha, that is also acceptable sometimes. But the point that I was trying to get out of this is that even if you would say that the halacha does not accept the secular view on what the kinyan is, in terms of the strict halachic opinion, the point is based on Dina de Malchusa Dina, you generally speaking can follow and would follow the law, according to the Ramah at least, you would follow the law of whatever land you're in terms of when the deal is binding or not. If you follow the Shach, on the other hand, if there's a machlokas between secular law and halacha, you might say no. That if you're talking about two Jews, you'd have to follow the Torah halacha instead. Again, the general approach is that we follow the Ramah. Okay.
Right.
Very good. Yeah.
Another issue, I don't know, probably. If I own one of those companies and I decide to go according to one versus the other, I say, okay, although it would be binding, I don't want to impose because according to Aloha it's not.
Right.
But I have various partners who might lose money by me taking the sort of the high road.
Right.
I have shareholders.
Right.
So
right.
Am I allowed?
Right.
It's not
good
only
question.
Run, it's, it has
good
to
question.
Be fully owned by me because it's not
good question. So that's a big question. You're
or
talking about when the people that are doing the business are Jewish. Are the shareholders
two,
Jewish?
The two CEOs are Jewish,
okay.
Home Jews, but they
okay.
have shareholders.
Good question. So this is going to be a complicated issue, which we don't have time to get into now. This goes to the heart of the question of whether halacha accepts the concept of a corporation. Is a corporation a halachic entity or only a secular entity? And according to halacha, it's something totally different. That is a major discussion and a major machlokas, which we're not going to get into today. If you want to have another shiur about that, that's another option we can throw out there for a shiur, which impacts a lot of different areas of halacha. Hilchos Shabbos, Hilchos Pesach, Hilchos Kashrus, owning stocks and things that have other forbidden types of foods in it that you can't get hana from. All sorts of issues are related to this question of what the status of a corporation is, what the status of the shareholders are, the CEO. Very unclear on the Modern Post. We have some interesting discussions about that question, but unfortunately we don't have time for it now.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Let's go on. So that's in terms of scenario number one. Let's talk about some other issues that come up when it comes to Dina de Malchus Adina. What'd you say?
We didn't do the run with Israel.
Well, that's where we're getting to it. Before we get to the run, before we get to that, just one other point I wanted to mention. Again, I don't want to get into this too much, but it is important to mention. It is worthwhile to mention. Let's take a look here.
Where did the Shach live?
Say again?
Where did the Shach live?
Where did the Shach live? In Europe. In I think in Poland, right? I think in Poland. He was in when did he live? In the 1600s. He was the one who was constantly running away from the Cossacks, unfortunately. He had a hard life. It was not easy for him. Okay, let's look at source number four. This is just a point that I wanted to mention also. Again, I don't want to get into this too much because this also has some interesting applications. But the principle of the matter we want to discuss briefly, is there any limit to Dina de Malchus Adina in terms of the amount of taxes that are imposed? So the Gemara in Nedarim, source number four, is commenting on a Mishnah. Basically, the Mishnah says, it's not here, but basically, it seems that maybe you don't actually have to listen to the tax collectors. If they come to you, you can try to get out of your taxes and sort of lie or try to find other ways to evade the taxes. So the Gemara says in source number four, Amar Shmuel, Dina de Malchus Adina. Don't we say Dina de Malchus Adina? So how can you do that? You have to pay the taxes. The answer is, we're talking about a tax collector who has absolutely no limit. He will collect whatever he can get his hands on. He'll search your house. Whatever money he finds, he will take. There is no set amount for the tax. Referring to a tax collector who gets up on his own. He's not appointed by the government, but rather he is what we call a pirate tax collector. He got up on his own and decided, I am going to... What'd you say?
Protection money.
Okay, if you want to call it that.
Medieval times, it used to be that you could buy the right to collect tax as a privilege, or you could be granted it as a privilege. That for a certain area, you would buy the rights to collect all the tax in that area, and it would be up to you how much you could extract.
Okay, good. Right. So that would be exactly. So if it could be similar to the previous case, but certainly anything which is not directly, if you are not directly a messenger of the government, then you would be included in this category. In which case, you're permitted to evade in certain methods, in certain ways, evade the tax. A little bit. What's the point here? The point is that there's not necessarily, no limit at all to this tax. The point is that any tax which is not appointed directly by the government or that there is no limit to the tax, that tax will not be halachically valid based on Dina de Malchus Adina. And again, I don't want to get into the details now because we're not going to have time to discuss anything else, but the Ramah does mention in source number seven, the Ramah quotes, either the Ramah or the Shulchan Aruch, he quotes this halacha from the Gemara, and basically what he says is essentially what the Gemara says, that if he gets up on his own or he has no limit in terms of what he can take, then he takes whatever he wants. That halacha of Dina de Malchus Adina does not apply. But if you want to follow right in the middle of line two in source number seven, right after the period, but if the tax collector is appointed by the king to take a certain amount of tax, even if the Jews have a special tax, the Jews have to pay more than the non-Jews, as long as it is a set amount. It's called a set amount, meaning the Jews have to pay $100 more per month than everybody else, But that is still apparently considered to be a set amount, and according to this, it would seem to be that even in that case, that still qualifies as dina de malchusa dina. Okay, again, that may have certain implications for other taxes and other kinds of things that we had spoken, and some of us had spoken about before, when it comes to progressive taxes, that rich people sometimes get billed more taxes than the poor people. This Rama would seem to support the notion that that's still considered to be dina de malchusa dina, as long as there's a set amount for each group separately. Again, we don't have time to get into the details of this now, but that's just, I wanted to make the basic point about that. Okay, let's go on to the next point. Let's talk about Eretz Yisrael for a couple minutes, and then we'll come back and try to discuss some of these scenarios in the first section. What's the story with Eretz Yisrael? Is there any reason why Eretz Yisrael might be, we'll call it, more special, more unique, or different when it comes to the application of Dina de Malchus and Dina, based on what we've seen so far?
Jewish.
And therefore what? Okay, good. So there's a couple points that we can raise here. Again, we're not going to discuss all these points in detail, but just to raise the basic issues. Issue number one, perhaps the state of Israel is not included in Dina de Malchus HaDina. Why not? Because in Eretz Yisrael, the expectation in Israel, and certainly what was in the times of Tanakh, is that the king is obligated to follow halacha. That's part of the point of what he's supposed to do, to support the halacha and encourage everyone else to follow the halacha. So if we now have a Jewish state, but they're not following the halachic rules for Dine Mamonos, perhaps that might mean that they have no authority to institute or legislate any taxes or anything else. We don't have to follow that, because the whole rule of Dina de Malchus HaDina applies to secular governments. But if you have a Jewish government, they have to follow the Torah. And if they don't do that, finished. That's question number one. Hey, the answer, well, I'll ask question number two first. Question number two, which Rishon might you say has a potential nafkamina that according to that Rishon, you would say that Eretz Yisrael might be different in terms of the application of Dina de Malchus HaDina that we saw before? Anybody remember? What'd you say? Second? That was one of the bases for it, but the Rishon that we saw before that actually said, he almost said it explicitly. It was in the, anybody remember? It was in the Ran. It was almost explicit in the Ran, in source number five. I mentioned it, we didn't read it inside. I'll read it inside right now. So let's look at the Ran in source number five very quickly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, start right in the middle of the first line. Bekasva b'tosvo. So the Ran quotes a Tosvos here, which I believe is not on the daf, but it's b'shem some of the Balei Tosvos. T'davka b'malchei ovdei kochavim amar d'dina d'malchus adina. Only with non-Jewish kings do we say dina d'malchus adina. Why? Mipnei sheha'aretz shalo, because he owns the land. V'yachal omar lahem, he can tell the people, im lo tasu mitzvosai, if you don't follow my rule, agareish eschem min ha'aretz, you are out, you're finished, get out, I'll get my policeman and kick you out. Okay, 1 second. Aval b'malchei Yisrael lo, but for Jewish kings, that would not necessarily apply. Why? Lefish Eretz Yisrael, kol Yisrael shutaf inba, because in the land of Israel, every single Jew has a chelek, is a partner in the land of Israel. We're going to leave out the last part of the Ran, because it's not directly relevant to our point right now. But basically what the Ran is saying in this section here appears to be that any situation where you have a Melech Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, you would say that they do not have the right to tell somebody, if you live here, you got to follow my rules, and if not, you have to get out, because every person has a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, every person has a chelek in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, you would say that a Melech Yisrael can't do that, and therefore we would say that perhaps Dina de Malchus HaDina doesn't apply. Again, this is all based on, 1 second, this is all based on the Svara of the Ran, that the reason for Dina de Malchus HaDina is that that the king can kick you out if you don't listen to his rules. According to the other Rishonim, this would not necessarily follow. The other Rishonim that talked about accepting upon yourselves voluntarily the rule of the king, the idea that you have to have society, has to have rules, those are all, this would not necessarily be true according to them, but according to the Ran, one could say that that the king cannot kick you out in Eretz Yisrael. Now, does that always happen? No, we know, unfortunately, that sometimes people do get kicked out of certain areas of Eretz Yisrael. But I think the point of the Ran, I think, would be that, in theory, you shouldn't be allowed, according to halacha, to be kicked out. I mean, halacha would dictate that you cannot be kicked out. According to halacha, the secular king could kick you out if he wants to, but in Eretz Yisrael, halacha would say that the king can't kick you out, and if he does kick you out, the king himself is violating halacha, which is not allowed according to the Torah. That's, I think, where the Ran might stand according to this. Let me just answer the questions, and then you can ask. But just give me another...
To the Rashbam,
second?
Even according to the Torah of the Rashbam,
yeah.
Or the Rambam,
yeah.
Any non-religious government in,
yeah,
Israel, you could say, doesn't have the
Haskama
of the Hashavim.
I hear what you're saying.
And therefore, you don't have to listen to them. And so, even if it's got to ask about the Toshavim now, it's just because the Toshavim now are not the Toshavim who should really be here.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. The question is, do the majority of citizens in the land of Israel really accept the government? And what is Haskamat Toshavim? Meaning, is Haskamat Toshavim almost everybody? Is it 50%?
Even if you say it's 50%, right. But who are the Toshavim? The fact that you ought to have Toshavim who aren't here and should be here, and you have Toshavim who are here and maybe shouldn't be here, makes the definition of Haskamat Toshavim something very...
Okay, I hear the point, a very interesting point. I didn't see that point mentioned explicitly. Presumably because you have to decide who, practically, how does it apply? How do you say Haskamat Toshavim? Who do you include? When do you include people that are here, people that are not here?
At the time of the British, but, where they're stopping people coming,
understood.
They're creating
artificial
majority in one way or another.
I hear. It could be a good point. It could be a good point.
What about the fact that as a tourist coming to, when I was coming to Israel, I had to have my passport was stamped with a visa, and I could stay here for a certain amount of time. And if I stay overstayed, then that created a problem.
Right.
But then I would argue, well, I can't be overstaying my welcome in Eretz Yisrael.
Right. I hear. The answer is go get your visa extended. I said the answer is go get your visa extended.
Right, but on the other hand, I shouldn't have to get a visa.
According to the Ron, you're correct, but. The question is whether we pass like the Ron. That's the question. Yeah.
Maybe you could say a question to answer now. But in olden times, there used to be a civil administration in Israel, which wasn't with an equivalent of the police and the equivalent of punishment, which isn't necessarily as clearly defined in Halakha. So there was always the concept of a civil administration. It's not like it's a new Kiddush with the Medina.
Okay.
It's always been there, and presumably that's covered under the dinim of kingship, which is different.
What do you mean by civil administration? Do you mean in the times when the Jews were sovereign in Israel? Meaning during the Beis Hamikdash time period?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So that's true. There definitely was, but along the way, during the time of the first Beis Hamikdash, it was all kings, meaning the king had the absolute right. During the time period of the second Beis Hamikdash, so maybe what you're saying is more true. The latter period of that, of the second temple, also wasn't necessarily directly ruled by the Jews. Certain parts were, but by the end already, the Romans were already ruling it. The question, I guess, is like this. This is a bit of a discussion. Some Rishonim want to say that any Jewish government in the land of Israel has the halakhic status of a king. The Ramban seems to say that in the Hasagos L'Sefer HaMitzvos. He doesn't quite say it straight out, but he pretty much says it. Rav Shechter likes to quote that opinion all the time. He likes to say that that any Jewish administration, Jewish government, would be included as the status of a king, and therefore that would certainly be included in all of these kinds of rules.
Second,
correct. That's what Rav Shechter wants to say based on the Ramban, and others have said the same thing.
But the government
also has. Second. It could be that there is offhand, I don't remember anything. Very possible. But offhand, I don't remember seeing any specific Makoros that discussed this directly. But in the modern postgame, this is a bit of a discussion.
But the government also is not made up solely of Jews.
That's also true. So the postgame talk about this, and again, we don't have time to get into this now, but Rav Herzog has a discussion about this, I think in his sefer called Techuka Yisrael al-Pi HaTorah, something like that. Shal Yisraeli also has a discussion in one of his farm called Amud HaYemini. There are a number of postim that discusses, and basically what they want to say along the same lines, essentially, that the Knesset today also has the status of this type of Jewish kingdom, and therefore you have to follow those rules also, based on the Parsha of Melech. Now, again, there's a lot to discuss here, and we don't have time for it now, but definitely, according to some postim, there definitely is room to say that that is absolutely the case. According to others, maybe not. Yeah?
The whole way through Tanakh, you see numerous examples of kings who were not the most shining example of how to run a Jewish state.
Yes.
At least we're not getting idols worship.
Right.
But nonetheless, all the halachas of Malchus nevertheless still applied them to them,
Correct.
Why would we think that just because it's a bunch of heretics running the show,
right,
that the rules suddenly change?
Good point. Good point. And I think that's what a lot of these poskim are going to say. That certainly that model of Melech was following that. The only thing that you might answer is just that they might have been worshiping idols, but when it came to civil laws, Dina Mamonos issues, did they actually not follow the Torah when it came to all sorts of Dina Mamonos issues? The answer may be yes. They stole whatever they wanted. They took whatever they wanted. But if the regular rules would have been, yeah, what?
They even arranged false testimony in order to get
right.
fees.
So that's,
that
so that's true.
Careful,
the question was that part of the actual rules of the land? Was that part of the law, or was it just that the kings violated the law, meaning everybody knew what the law was, but the king just didn't keep the law? To be honest, I thought about this question myself this afternoon. I thought about it a little bit, and I didn't have a solid answer. I think there is discussion about it, and I didn't happen to have seen
I'm
it before this year.
The king kept the law. The fact that he had to find a false witness in order to get his field Hav.
Ahav. Right. So I hear
so
that could be
him getting false.
Right.
He wanted a field that he had to arrange
right.
false witnesses.
Right. Right. I hear.
Like that to get.
So that might be a support then that they did.
Because
that in
they
some
kept
way they kept the law. They kept the law.
The king had the executive power, but
right.
on a day-to-day basis, it would be the Sanhedrin.
Okay, so that's true. That's also a good point. And of course, we don't have time to get into it. Now, Rav Schechter briefly discusses a little bit about that question. There are a number of other discussions about it as well.
But
it's mainly it's based on the king, though. I mean, the main issue is the Parsha of the Melech. That's what I think the Meiri and the Vilna Gaon and a number of other Mepharshim say. That the bottom line is that it's based on the king. The Sanhedrin may play a role, but basically it's the Melech. That's the source. Yeah, this is going to be the last question before we go on because we don't have time.
Is that the Jewish king is in Eretz Yisrael.
Correct.
For example,
correct.
Had,
yes.
Had Joe Lieberman, for example, become president of the United States.
Right. Right.
What?
Excellent question. I think the answer would be. I thought of this also. I think the answer would be that the regular Dina de Malchus and Dina would apply even according to the Ran, because the basis for the Ran's reason is only that every Jew has a shutvus, has a partnership, and a chelik in Eretz Yisrael, which is not true about England or the United States of America. So even if it was a Melech Yisrael, presumably his logic wouldn't necessarily apply. Okay, let's go on, just because we don't have so much time here. We'll have to hold off on the questions for the next 10 minutes or so. What's the bottom line when it comes to the Ran? So we don't have time to read it inside, but if in source number 7, the Shulchan Aruch appears to paskin against the Ran. The Shulchan Aruch appears to paskin. It's, if you want to look at it yourself, it's 3, 6, 7 lines from the top of source number 7 in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Shin Samach Tes, and Choshen Mishpah. Basically, the Shulchan Aruch says that you cannot avoid taxes. It's ki'ilu, you're stealing, you're over alo sigzo, because Mineshu gozol manas hamelach, you're stealing the portion from the king, and that applies whether the king is Jewish, whether he's a Melech Yisrael, whether he is a non-Jewish king. So the pashas of the Shulchan Aruch appears to be that he paskins, and most of the Rishonim paskin, against the Ran in this situation, and therefore, even for a Jewish king, you would still have to apply the rules of Dina de Malchus Adina. Now, Rav Schechter points that out as well, and many other poskim have noted that as well. There was a rumor, this is not clear, there was a rumor that the Chazon Ish was reported to have said that maybe there is room to rely on the Ran in modern-day Eretz Yisrael. There's a rumor. The Chazon Ish never, in any of his writings, as far as I know, never actually wrote that. So Rabbi David from Beit Shemesh told me, I heard this at least twice from him, I think, that I think he said he asked his son to go ask Rav Chaim Kanievsky about this point one time. He was embarrassed to ask him himself. He asked his son to ask Rav Chaim. And he asked him two questions. Question number one, did the Chazon Ish really say you can pass like the Ran in Eretz Yisrael? Question number two, is it permitted to steal money from the Medina? So the first question he didn't respond to. The second question, after he asked, is it permitted to steal money from the Medina? Did the Chazon Ish ever say that was okay? Rav Chaim Kanievsky jumped out of his seat and yelled, Sheker v'chazov! Absolutely false. He never ever said that. So you have to think about that. Take it for what it's worth. But that was one interesting point that you should consider. When you hear oral rulings from people, you have to be careful. Again, maybe he said it, maybe he didn't. But the bottom line is it's not so clear. At least my rabbanim definitely told that we don't follow the Ran. And even in Eretz Yisrael, the normative rule is that you have to follow Dina de Malchus Adina, would apply even here. And the secular government also, as we mentioned before, also may qualify as a regular Malchus. Okay, let's go on just because I want to have some time for the scenarios. Let's talk about some of the practical applications of these principles. The principles are pretty clear. Dina de Malchus Adina applies in many cases of secular law, including paying taxes. Question is bottom line. So how do we come out in some of the more difficult scenarios? Everybody agrees, and Again, this unfortunately is a problem, as we mentioned before, in many places, that people, especially Orthodox Jews, sometimes do not pay taxes. They cheat on their taxes, which involves a lot of different isurim, gneva stas, perhaps sheker, a lot of different things, that if you cheat or fraud or you falsify documents or you don't report things, all of these things are serious, serious problems, and l'chora should be spoken out about. I'm not going to read it inside now, but if you take a look at the article that I put for you here on source number 10, from Ellie Clark, he basically is very upset about this whole phenomenon and why the Rabbanim have not spoken out about it. So Rosh Hashanah, not in my community, the Rabbanim has spoken out about it. Rosh Shachter has given many, many shiurim. Some you can find on yutorah.org. He has this article in the RJJ Journal. He's very, very against cheating on taxes. And he discusses all the different issues that are involved.
He's not discussing about
no comments. No comments. There's some other issues also that I didn't bring up, which we're not going to have time to get into now. And that's the question of avoiding paying back a loan if you owe a non-Jew money. Are you allowed to just not pay him back the money as part of the loan? That's a bit of a question. But the bottom line is that even there, even if there are kulas to not pay him back, if it involves chilul Hashem or dina d'machus and dina on a government level, Rosh Hashanah believes, and many others also believe, that there's absolutely no room for leniency there, and you absolutely must pay taxes. So now let's go to some of these scenarios.
Sorry.
Yeah, sure, please.
I want to just challenge you on that.
Okay.
I understand that, and for me it makes perfect sense.
Okay.
Both in Israel and in Kutzar, mm-hmm. see evading tax as being normative behavior.
Okay.
It's a chi, not a chi.
Okay.
It's normative.
Okay. Okay.
To work in the black economy and to treat cash as the way of doing is normative.
Right.
It's reached that sort of
right.
level. And
right.
Are you saying there is absolutely no halakhic basis behind that whatsoever amongst any poskim of those communities? Because that can't be the case. Because there cannot be that much willful desecration of halakha in communities that focus very heavily on...
Understood. Good question. In Eretz Yisrael, we discussed already, I don't believe that there is so much room to be makel in Eretz Yisrael, and we'll have to discuss some of the practical scenarios in just a minute, but at least you can understand where they're coming from. They have some sort of basis here in Eretz Yisrael, based on the Ran and the secular government, that's one thing. In Chutz Laaretz, it's much harder to find a solid basis for what they do. I can't say that their rabbanim have not, I don't know what their rabbanim say, I haven't asked them. Nobody's going to write anything in print, of course, because then the government might arrest them if they find out what they wrote. What I know from my rabbanim, and what you see clearly from the poskim, seems to be very clear that there's not really any room for taxes specifically, maybe for other issues, but certainly not for taxes. There's no room, as far as I understand it, no room to be makil on cheating taxes and avoiding taxes. The only issue that they might say is what I mentioned before, which again, I didn't want to get into the details now because I don't think we have time, but it's what's called hafkas halva aso. That the halacha is that if you owe a non-Jew money, even though he's allowed, in this case, the non-Jew might be allowed to legislate taxes, the question is that means that you owe the non-Jew money. It's ki'ilu, he lent you money and you have to pay back the money. So the halacha is that you are allowed to evade repaying the non-Jew the money for the money that was lent to you. That's the halacha. You're allowed to not pay him back the money that he already gave you. The question is whether that actually permits not paying the taxes. And that's the question that Rosh Shechter deals with a little bit at length here. And the answer is, it's a question in the poskim. Some of the poskim, including the Vilna Gaon and others, say that that's not true. I forgot who says what here already. But basically they say that that's not true for a number of different reasons. One reason that's given is, we mentioned before, Chil Hashem. And this, I think, is already clear from a number of the other poskim. Yeah, the Kesef Mishnah discusses this, the Vilna Gaon in the section of Choshen Mishpat what you read before, basically say that any case where there's a potential of Chil Hashem, it is absolutely, it might be mutter technically, but because of Chil Hashem, it's still usser to not pay your taxes. It could be that they ignore the Chil Hashem point of view and just take the Hafkas Halva Aso aspect of that, but I find that, you know, that in terms of Chil Hashem, that's exactly what the problem is today. Everybody sees, oh, these Orthodox Jews again got caught for embezzling or for this or for that. It's terrible. You see it on the front page of the New York Times or this paper and that paper. It's a major, major Chil Hashem. And personally, I don't see it, at least from my opinion, I don't see how that, you know, with the Chil Hashem aspect, it would be a heter.
What's the halachic definition of Chilul Hashem?
Okay, good. You're correct. But I mean, most postgame, you're right. There are gemaras about it that discuss specific situations of what when it applies. But the bottom line is that I think most people... Most people, I think, would say, yes. You're right.
If it's not an Aveira, even if it's the Rabbim, it's not Chilul Hashem.
You're right. The problem is here. No, the problem is here like this. I agree with what you're saying, and there are certain rules, but here the Vilna Gaon and the Kesef Mishnah, I think, explicitly say that if it's a situation of Chilul Hashem, then you can't avoid paying back the non-Jew. And the question is, in their mind, I think this is a case where they would have said that this is a Chilul Hashem. Even if you say technically it's not a Chilul Hashem, tachlis, it's a Chilul Hashem. Assuming that Chilul Hashem applies, when everybody finds out that Orthodox Jews are not, you know, keeping the secular law, you know, it's definitely a question. Number two, though, as Rav Schechter points out, we saw it inside, but in the Ramban, one of these big Shulchan Aruchs here, the Ramban also says that in terms of paying taxes, hafgas halva also does not get, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for governmental taxes. Only applies for individual non-Jews, but it does not necessarily apply. Yeah, it's in source number 7. It does not necessarily apply on the rule of paying taxes. Dina de Malchus Adina overrides hafgas halva also from a government perspective. And he's not the only one. A number of other achronim accept that as well. So the bottom line is, I'm not sure exactly how they defend it. I'm curious to hear. But we should go find out. I'm curious to know, but I can't think of any good defenses in Chutz Laretz for it. Okay, let's go on here. Let's look at some of the scenarios. Scenario number 2. A taxi driver or anyone else who gets paid in cash only declares 80% of what he actually gets paid as income. The rest he pockets. Is this okay? What if it's normal that all the taxi drivers do this? So what do you say in this situation? What would you say very quickly?
Okay. You know, it's normative for laws which it's not normative to break.
Okay. Good. Anybody want to disagree with that, or y'all?
So, for example, if you drive at 32 miles per hour in a 30 mile an hour limit,
okay,
that's normative behavior. Everyone does that.
Excellent.
So that's not a problem.
Good. Okay, let me just spend a minute or two talking about this. We can go on for a long time with this point, but I want to get to their scenario, so we're not going to have a lot of discussion about this. This is a very... What would you say? I didn't put it on the scenario sheet on purpose, the traffic laws. It's a big one. This is a very ambiguous area when it comes to the written literature and the poskim. What we've seen so far, the poskim don't discuss this case where a lot of people do not keep the law. What I have seen quoted in some of the, you know, just the offhand, like Mipi HaShmua oral type of literature, is that some poskim are prepared to permit certain activities if not only the fact that most people are doing them are violating the law, but number two, the secular authorities themselves are not mocking about it. So at this point, in terms of some of the traffic laws, if you go only a couple miles or kilometers over the speed limit, so a number of rabbanim, both unnamed and named, I saw one quote from Rav Moshe Feinstein, from Rav Yisrael Reisman on the internet, and others I know I've spoken to myself, other rabbanim I know accept this opinion. If it's something that you know that the cop, even if he sees you going in America 65 in a 55 zone, or whatever it is in England, whatever the equivalent is, he's not going to stop you. Why? Because they just don't stop people unless it gets to be too much over the speed limit. If that's the situation, even though you know that the actual law is that the speed limit is a little bit lower than that, the halach would be that you don't have to be more machmer on dina de machlus adina than the government themselves. So if they're not going to be machmer about it, then many poskim, though not all, will tell you that that's permitted. Therefore, in any of these kinds of cases where everyone does it, if you know for certain that the government is not machmer, meaning they'll tell you what the law is, yes, it's on the books, but the bottom line is that they see people doing it, or they're aware, and you know they could easily catch people, and they don't bother to actually try, so then it could be that there's room to be makil. However, what's not so clear, or what is clear in the other direction, is let's say a lot of people do it, but the government is machmir. A lot of cases like this, that people do it, it's very common, but yet, again, the government is not going to catch every single person. They may not, you know, go on a witch hunt, right, to try to find the people. But certainly, if they actually, an inspector actually saw somebody doing it, if they walked right past them and, you know, doing something illegal, they might stop them and give them a fine or do something else. In that situation, it's unclear what the rule is. Some people will say that's a problem of dina de malchus adina, and you can't do that, right? Even if everybody's doing it, so what? Just because everybody's doing it is not a heter to violate a halacha. And therefore, if the government would be machmir if they found out. If they saw it, you have to be machmir. On the other hand, I saw in a tshuva of Eretz from Eretz Chemda that Rav Daniel Rosenfeld just sent me yesterday. This is not in their Sfarim. Their Sfarim, this tshuva is a new one. It hasn't gotten out yet. So he wants to suggest here, based on a number of makoros, that perhaps the rules of Dina de Machlus Adina of applying the rules of the land only apply to Dina Mamonos when it comes to taxes or taking money for the government. But when it comes to other rules, such as traffic laws, he wants to suggest, he talks about here about running a red light. maybe it's dangerous. It might be, you know, a question of nishmartim ol l'nafsho seichem, but he wants to suggest that maybe that's not a problem of dina d'malchus ad-dina, because it's not that a monetary law per se. It's a different kind of law. And therefore, when the Ramah says, and we didn't have a chance to discuss this Ramah because I forgot to put it on the first source sheet, some of you might have it, that the Ramah includes anything that's called takanas b'nei ha-medina, anything which is beneficial for society is included in dina d'malchus ad-dina. But does that mean only that the government can make the law, or does that mean that you have to follow the law? That's part of the question. So he wants to say here, that only means that the government can make the law. In terms of you following the law, you don't have to follow the law if it has nothing to do with the government, you know, with monetary issues. If it's an issue of traffic law, if you get fined, if they catch you and you get fined, you got to pay the fine. But do you actually have to follow the law? The answer is maybe not. And others will disagree. Others will say, well, no. The Ramah says the reason why he's talking about instituting the law is that if any law which benefits society is instituted, you got to keep it. And therefore, any of these cases, you'd not only have to pay the fine, but you also would have to keep it as well. So that's a bit of a gray area, which I'm still not entirely clear about. When I spoke to Rabbi David about this, he seemed to be in the direction that even if everybody's doing it, that doesn't necessarily permit it. It's something that is only if the government would actually say, would actually not be machbid about, might it be okay. But otherwise, if they would be machbid, even if they don't always catch everybody, and they don't always try, but definitely, you know, if they actually saw somebody doing it, they'll stop them. And he felt that maybe that's not considered to be an acceptable heter. Okay, let's go on to some of the other scenarios, and then if you want to continue afterwards, we can continue a little bit. Number three, I think we're going to skip. This is a very difficult one. I'll read the question, I'll just make one comment, but this is a tough one and not exactly our topic here, though somewhat related. A homeowner goes to the Iriyah to get a permit for a home extension. Of course, this doesn't happen in Yad Ben Yamin. The clerk tells him that he will give him a permit only if the homeowner gives him 1,000 shekel cash. That's not part of the permit fee. That was obviously off the books. The homeowner is determined to build the extension. Does he pay the bribe and get the permit, or build without the permit? Meaning, should you do the work illegally here and not follow Dina de Malchus Adina, or should you pay the bribe, which the guy, you know, the clerk wasn't supposed to be charging you in the first place?
Is that Dina de Malchus Adina also?
That's a question. The answer there, I think, would be absolutely not, because that's something which is totally, you know, for, I would think it's considered similar to the person that gets up on his own and decides to make a tax without being, you know, authorized by the government. When I asked Radia this question, he wasn't sure. First he said he doesn't know, and then, as we spoke about it for another minute or two, it seemed to be that he thought, and I think I heard this from somebody else as well, that if you want to get the permit, you can get the permit, and just, you know, don't say you're giving him a bribe. Just say, I'm giving you a little gift just to make sure that things go smoothly, or something along those lines. But this is a tough question. This is not an easy question. What'd you say? Yeah, just give it to him. Don't say what it is. But I'm saying, if he views it as a bribe, that's a little more problematic. And the laws of Shochad may apply more to Beis Din than to just a clerk. But
in most Western countries, the governments are very much about their bar.
So the question is, what can you do? So I don't know what's going to happen if you report him. What's he, you know?
He'll get fired.
So maybe you should give him the money and then report him. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. It's a good question. What?
Both go to jail.
Right. Okay, so that's a question. Or you report him before he gives you a work permit, and then he'll get fired, and then afterwards you try again. I don't know. Okay, let's go on to number four here. Tax regulations. I am an accountant for a client which has a certain amount of income, which is questionable whether it must be reported according to Israeli tax law. Should I report it or not? Yitz's wife gave me a couple other more complicated scenarios, which I actually had trouble following because she's an accountant and I'm not. So, David also told me, he said he has trouble with some of these cases because he could tell him he's a rogue, you know, he doesn't understand all the nuances of accounting and the way everything works. So all we can deal with is what we understand here. In this type of basic question here, what would you say in number four?
First of all, should you report it as a rule, even if it's not questionable? You're the accountant.
Okay, good question. The answer to that question depends on some of the questions.
You're saying if it's questionable, so you can go like this or like that. It's shita that you shouldn't, that you don't have to.
So here's the question. So when it comes to something which is clearly on the books that you're supposed to report, based on what we've said so far, it would seem to be that Dina d'Malchus Adina should apply. And therefore, if they mandate that you have to give a certain amount of tax, then you should have to report that. Now, if you tell me that every single person that's doing this is not reporting this minuscule amount of money, so then we go back to the question from before. Does that mean that everybody does it, it's okay, or do we say,
I am someone.
By the way, taxes, again, what we mentioned before about the Eretz Chem, the Tshuva, is not relevant to taxes. The question of traffic laws is different because it's not about money.
No.
Only in a non-money situation can we say, well, if they don't find you, that it's okay. But for taxes, everybody agrees that taxes, you have to pay. If they don't find you, that's considered to be money of the government. The question there was just, well, if everybody does it, maybe that's a heter. You know, probably not, but that was the question. Yeah.
Nowadays, any financial infraction is probably linked with money laundering in one way or another. And there are money laundering laws.
Right.
So even if you say, well, okay, you don't fall into the tax category,
right?
You know, surely if
If you're
sending
dinner to Muslims for dinner
applies,
you'd be caught under money laundering regardless.
Right.
So
therefore,
second.
Good.
Under money laundering regulations in the UK as an accountant, I have to report. I have to report a client or someone I believe is breaking money laundering.
Okay.
I'm not allowed to tell them.
Understood.
So
yeah. So you. Yeah. Good. So that's
but
really.
Here's
yeah.
The
sorry.
Was,
yeah.
Dinner to Muslims dinner. Can I shop a Jew to the authorities?
Good. So that's a separate question. That's why I left it off this that scenario off this. He didn't want to give an answer. Okay. So that's a different.
He wanted to give was no, you can't.
Good. So that's a question of misira. Are you allowed to inform on a fellow Jew to the governmental authorities? That is a major, major discussion and a bit of a machlokas. That might be. I think that's another good shear that we should have if we continue this. You know, for the next couple shear, question of whistleblowing. Is whistleblowing allowed specifically for a fellow Jew? A lot of the posts have discussed it. There are reasons to say that it might be allowed, but. We have to go through the sugya first, so we're going to leave that one out for now. But certainly, if there, whatever the rules are according to the government, presumably, I would think that just because, and this Rabbi David seems to agree with as well, just because everybody does it does not necessarily mean that that's a heter. If the government basically would be machmed, if they saw it, if they investigated it, and they found, you know, this is the rule, I think if they would be machmed, I would think that probably you have to do it. If in number four, if it's questionable, it's a bit of a gray area, then already it's not so clear, then there's room to be a little bit more makil. Or David said in this type of situation where it's unclear, maybe you can follow what he felt. If most honest, reasonable CFOs would not report it, again, honest and reasonable being very important here, then he felt that that in that case you could be makil for sure. That was one way that he gave to try to determine how to go about some of these kinds of cases if you want to be honest about it. Okay, that's again a very, very basic case in scenario number four about taxes. There are a lot of other more detailed cases which we don't have time to go into now. He mentioned that to me. He told me that. Oh, really? So he mentioned to me that his brother is a tax accountant, and he said that he's tremendous. He's very, very good, and he knows the tax laws backwards and forwards. And he said sometimes in America,
very conservative.
Right. So he told me that in America they basically they caught him a couple times and doing things, and every single time he said they took him to court. The court didn't know what to do with him because he was making diukim back and forth from the laws. They didn't know how to respond because he was so well versed that even though they thought he was wrong, they couldn't slug him up because like a gemara, he had all his rayas straight from the books there. So in that kind of situation, if you have somebody like that who knows his stuff well enough to be able to prove one way or the other, then already, you can rely on whatever he says, even if it's lakula, that, presumably is allowed. Absolutely, there would be room to be makil in that situation. Okay, number five. How far do I have to go to ensure that the law is being followed? A Jewish contractor in London is offering to do an extension to our house of £20,000 in cash, or $23,500 by check. He will only provide a VAT receipt if a check is given. I have no idea if he declares tax in line with the law, but I know that it is common that builders don't. Am I allowed to pay the cash amount? If he is not Jewish, doesn't matter. This is a tough question also, very difficult question. I'll tell you just very briefly what I found so far, and again, we might have to go on because we're already running out of time here. The answer is like this. The answer is, let me start the answer with a question. What's the basis of this question here? The basis of this question, is there a halachic problem of lifnei either or misayeli de ovri avera? To shop or to buy or to do business with someone who you know does not pay taxes. Are you violating the thing either helping causing somebody else to sin? Or misayeli de'ovri avera, you are helping somebody else sin. This we spoke about a little bit in the context of the Shabbat shiur.
But is it your responsibility to find out? Or you're just saying if you do
1 second, so we'll get there in a second.
If I offer a guy cash instead of credit card, my reason for offering him cash, I don't think he's not gonna pay taxes. I'm saying I know the credit cards charge a percentage.
Right.
And it costs them.
Right.
So you need to take cash and it's
right.
gonna charge
right.
20,000 to 23,500.
Yeah.
Which
okay.
just happens to be the amount of that.
I'm not talking about this example, I'm talking about whatever.
And he won't get that
receipt. He'll take cash or kind of check or whatever, a small amount. I think the credit card is
right.
a cost to the store owner.
So this is exactly the case also, and if you look at source number 10, the first paragraph in source number 10, basically, a woman in Toronto told the person who wrote the article the story that she went shopping in a basement boutique. She kept asking the saleswoman if the price included sales tax. Yes, yes, it does. She asked him again, can you give me a receipt? Oh, if you want a receipt, then I'll have to charge you more. As it happens, sale receipts do not generally cost extra in Canada. But printing a receipt does create a record of the sale, a record that could come to the attention of the local tax authorities. And as it happens, it just happens to be that both of the people in the story were Orthodox Jews. This is exactly the question. Do you violate an Isra of Lifnei either of some sort in this case? And is it a question of Chil HaShem? So the answer, according to Rav Soloveitchik, as quoted by Rav Schechter, and Rav David told me that he heard this personally from the Rav as well, is that he felt that absolutely does violate Lifnei either. And therefore, according to the Rav was very, very machmed to say that you cannot shop from anybody that you know that you know, second, we didn't finish it, that you know does not pay taxes according to the law. That was the opinion of the Rav, and Rav Shechter also agrees with that opinion.
How many people know, though? I mean,
one second. We'll
just
get there.
Regarding that, he has to declare it, but when you're buying, you have to pay it.
Okay, good.
So by not paying that, it's not a problem of flavor. It's a problem that you're evading yourself.
Well, I've heard both sides of this.
Your intent is to pay.
That's not true.
What?
That's not true. It's your discretion. If you're selling something, it's your discretion whether the price is inclusive or exclusive.
Yes,
so
but
you as a seller have an obligation to pay VAT, for example.
Your obligation to take
it's your obligation to take that. Okay? Now, if for example, another example in Israel, a very common one is withholding tax on income tax, which is 30%. Now, if you do it correctly and you withhold the tax until the payee can technically get an exemption, then they can get their 30% back. If you don't withhold the 30%, then the government says, okay, you didn't withhold 30%, so you paid them 100,000. So the tax is not 30,000. You paid them, the transaction price was 100,000. Okay, so now you have to pay. You have to pay on top of that. Okay, so it's very, very clear. It's your obligation as the seller. It's your obligation to pay the VAT. And if you don't charge it, you still have to pay.
No, but I'm giving a specific case. There's an item which costs 1,000 plus tax, so 1,150.
Yeah.
Okay? Let's suppose that there's no issue of